Hey, kiddos. It's another night, another episode. Before we get started, I just want to remind you that I'm on Patreon, where right now I'm doing an experiment where I'm trying to do episodes like this every day. So if you're interested in what you're about to hear, if you enjoy it and you want to hear more, go over to patreon.com/Chad Hall, become a patron. Oh, I got some paper tonight, so you might hear the dramatic sounds of me turning the pages. I have, way more notes than I thought. I wasn't really intending on doing something from notes, but just something happened today, and I ended up doing like this brainstorm on paper, and I decided the brainstorm was something I wanted to talk about. So that's why you're going to hear paper noises and the normal sipping from my can of LaCroix noises. Hopefully the thing that I use to get rid of background noises doesn't get rid of the wonderful sound of that bubbling water. Otherwise, that will just sound completely stupid. You ever get those things that just... they sit in your head and you can't get rid of them, and they seem insignificant, but then they turn out to be what I call the snag of revolution. Now, revolution is a big word. It sounds so grandiose to say that, but the reason I use that term is because, you know, like revolutions, we tend to think of revolutions as something that happens all at once. But it's never something that happens all at once. It's something that's been building and building over small events over time. And that final event is just like the last piece. You know, the proverbial straw on the camel's back that breaks it. So to me, that's the snag of revolutions. There's just one little thing that grabs onto a part of your brain. And your brain can't let go of it because somewhere in your brain, a different part of your brain, perhaps the subconscious, knows that that little thing was the final piece. And so, you know, like there's these games where you're connecting pieces. And then when you connect all the pieces, like maybe it's like a mist type game or a puzzle game, or to get to the next thing, you have to move these objects, and oftentimes what they have are these connect the root. I guess they're called connect the root type puzzles. So it might look like an electrical box, and there are three nodes on the left and three nodes on the right, and you have to move all of these square and right angles or curves sometimes. You have to rotate them around and move them around until they make a line from one of the nodes across to the other side. But whenever you complete one of those things, those type of puzzles, even if you don't know what I'm talking about, it's pretty common in completing puzzles and games that the whole thing lights up with electricity shooting through it. And I feel like that's what happens with these snags, right? This snag is like the piece turns over. And then something is looking and going, okay, well, because of that, then this one turns this way. Almost like a Sudoku, right? You get that one number and you're like, okay, that's a 9. And that means that's a 6. And that means that's a 3. And then boom, you've solved the whole puzzle. But it's that one. It's not that one piece that solves the puzzle. It's that one piece that starts all of the connections. So your brain holds on to this thing because it's like, wait, that's important. But the conscious part of your brain's like, no, got to take the dog for a walk, and I got to put this box in the mail, and I need to do this. And in the back of your mind is going, remember that thing. And then all of a sudden, when you sit down and you just take a moment and you think about that thing, it connects to something else. And then that 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 connects to something else. And then all of a sudden you're sitting with what I have here, which is three pages of words and arrows and circles and Y's and scribbles. But it means something significant because all of a sudden, all of these little things, these little pieces that you've been collecting that you didn't know were part of something, or at least that you didn't know were part of something together, are suddenly apparent. They're suddenly apparently a whole. And maybe you don't even know what that whole is, but you know that all of this stuff is significant together and it does connect. So that snag for me, there's a guy on, I don't remember how. Oh, I do remember how. So there's an email newsletter that I subscribe to called Recommendo. And Recommendo, it's kind of neat. It's just like there's three people. I think it's just three people who run it. I can't remember all three of their names. One of them is Kevin Kelly, who's, if you're anything knowledgeable about Silicon Valley, you've heard of Kevin Kelly. He was the founder of Wired magazine. He's done a lot of other things as well. It's Kevin Kelly, a lady who unfortunately his name I can't remember. And then the only reason I know this guy's name is because I wrote his name down because he's part of this whole puzzle. But his name is Mark Frauenfelder. And he is one of the founders of Boing Boing. And Boing Boing is like it's a blog. It's a pretty famous blog. But it's like a blog that almost functions like an online magazine. But like in the old school style. I don't know. They just post stuff that they think is cool. It's not like a news source. At least the last time I looked at it. Who knows? Maybe it is now. I mean, MTV used to play music. Imagine that. Something going on with my voice tonight. I've got this frog in my throat. I swear to God, though, I did not have it 10 minutes before I started recording this. So, don't know what that is. Hopefully, it'll go away because it's driving me nuts. So, going back to Recommendo. What Recommendo does is those three pick something every week to share that they find useful, that they recommend. Typically, it happens, it's usually tools, whether it's like something physically that they've bought or whether it's a website or a web tool that they've run across. And it's usually the newsletter ends up being about, I think it's about 5 items every Sunday. So somebody is at least putting up more than one thing. You know, sometimes maybe it's like 3 from Kevin Kelly and 1 from one of the other two or each of the other two. Or sometimes 2 and 2 and 1, you know, whatever. However, it's not formulaic. And it's interesting because I've found, you know, like the kettle that I use to make my tea every day, I got from Recommendo. It was recommended. It was $15 and it's rad. It works great. So I've found a few useful things. Most of the time, it's nothing that I'm interested in, but I like reading what they're discovering. And it's short. You know, it's like a paragraph for each thing. So one of the things, I think it was in this week's issue, Mark Frauenfelder mentions something about his little alien drawings or little, it's not even, they're creatures. Some of them are aliens, some are monsters, some are other things. He does these little tiny little sketches. They're probably about the size of a quarter. And he'll do like a whole page of them so they're in a grid. And it's just really cool. And he was saying that he's starting to sell them on Society 6, like I did for a little while, of some of my designs. So I clicked over and I looked at that and I'm like, you know what? I like this, these little doodles. I like these. Wonder if he has an Instagram. Going over, found him on Instagram, started following him. Cool. Now I have a little bit of art. You know, like that's kind of where I thought it was going to end. But then I don't know if I was looking through the pictures or if I was reading his bio or something. Somehow I found out that he had a newsletter. And he had a newsletter on Substack called The Magnet. So I went over, I said, well, I'm curious what, you know, because to me, even though I knew he was connected to Recommendo, I didn't know he was connected to Boing Boing yet. I didn't know any of that stuff. So to me, he was just like a guy that was making art on Instagram. So I was like, I wonder what a guy who makes art on Instagram does in his newsletter. And I went over and I read his newsletter. I didn't realize he's writing something for Boing Boing every day, which props to him for doing that. I love everyday stuff, the everyday challenge, as you know. That's why we're here now. But I read the description of his newsletter. And there was one section. I think it's, is that one sentence? Yeah, I think it's one sentence, one long sentence. I didn't realize at the time I read it that it was revolutionary. It was just part of a paragraph, and I kept going back to it throughout the day. And I think this was a few days ago, so it's just been sticking with me. And today I went back and I reread it. You know, I finally acknowledged that snag like I was talking about. So I went back to it, and I'm like, what is it about that? And then something about the process right there began this whole interactive graph. You know, I'm saying that right now because I'm sitting in front of my computer where my Obsidian, the program that I do writing in, is, and there's a feature in there called the interactive graph, which looks exactly like what I'm imagining this three pages would look like if I were to graph it out. So here's the sentence, not to keep you in suspense. Here is the sentence that snagged, the snag that sent me reeling. And remember, this is not momentous. I didn't even realize it at the time that it was momentous. Every week in the magnet, I'll write about tips I find useful, things that interest me, what I've learned, interviews, recipes, quotations, and more. I'll also include excerpts from my favorite newsletters. Right? It is two sentences. I realize that now, but the main sentence is that first one. Because I think like that, now that I'm reading it to you, I'm realizing that that second sentence also include excerpts from my favorite newsletters. That seems to mitigate some of the impact of the sentence before. So maybe it masked that. And maybe that's why it took a while for me to realize that that sentence, where he starts listing off the things that he would do, it reminded me of something else. It reminded me of a notebook filled with rants, meditations, medications, book notes, hazy memories, true crime, critical thinking, conversations, obsessions, over-detailed tangents, sloppy philosophy, short fiction, technology, weirdness, and everything else. That is the description of my podcast. And I think when I made that connection, what I realized was, even though I went and I looked at the magnet, and it's cool, but it's not what I was thinking it was when I read this. But what I was thinking it was something that I've always, no, I don't want to say I've always wanted to build, because that's not true. This, you know, this late night radio thing, this is the thing that I always wanted to build. This is the thing that I think it's the thing that I wanted to build that I didn't know I wanted to build. The thing that the parable, I guess maybe it's a parable of the elephant, where they take all of the people of different religions and they blindfold them and they have them go and touch the elephant. And they ask them to describe the elephant from just what they're touching. You know, one only touches the foot. Another one's only touching, so they, you know, they're only touching the foot. So they describe it kind of like a tree. And the other one's only touching the trunk, so they describe it kind of like a snake. And the other one is only touching the ear, so they describe it like a curtain or a drape. And it's not people of different religion doing it. It's just different people. The comparison with the elephant is with religion. that God or the divine is the elephant, and everybody's just touching one part, and they think that they know the whole thing, but they've only really touched one part. So they don't understand the entirety. That's what I think this is. Even though, like, I haven't fully defined the this in what it is, I will try to explain it, but it's the elephant. And when I say it's the thing I always wanted to build but didn't know I want to build, it's because I was continually grabbing pieces of the elephant and thinking that I was building something. Like, this is my thing, but I was really only, it was only the foot. Or this is my thing, and it was really only the trunk. Or this is my thing, and it was only the ear. But what I really wanted to build was the elephant, and I didn't know because I couldn't see more of the elephant. I don't want to say I've seen the whole elephant, but I've seen more of the elephant. So I'm not sure how to really, you know, this is what I have on here. It's not notes, really. This is just scribbled brainstorm. So I'm not really sure how to explain what I'm talking about, except to walk you through the journey of realization here. Okay. So it's just going to be like, I'm going to mention something and be like, and then that reminded me of this, and that reminded me of this. That's kind of what it's going to be like. But what I'm describing is not just a journey. I'm describing parts of the elephant. I just didn't realize that all of these things that these are all things that interest me, that they were all part of one thing, theoretically. So, reading the descriptions of Magnet, of the Magnet, and rereading the description of my own show, what that reminds me of is magazines. And I don't mean just like Rolling Stone or a magazine you pick up now. I mean like magazine culture, which is a very different thing, because magazine culture, you know, like the New Yorker is a great example of, you know, it's like institutionalized now in the sense that like it's just, they're like one of the greats, and like we don't see what they're doing as revolutionary anymore. It's like, it's a formula that somebody else could copy or whatever. But like really what they were doing and what they're still doing, they've just continued to do it, is made a magazine about New York culture. And that's why they have short stories in there, and why they have cartoons in there, and why they have sections about what's going on around town. You know, what's going on in the theater? What's going on in this new hotel? The magazine was more than just something you picked up on paper and read. The magazine was, it was like a connection point for culture. It's like they're curating culture around you. If you're a New Yorker and you pick up the magazine called The New Yorker, it can connect you to other things. You know, you can't, the magazine is not the entirety of the experience. It's just, it's some experiences that are just able to be experienced on the page, you know, like the cartoon or the short story or the political article. Those are those are complete on the page, but everything else in there is telling you about something that you have to experience outside of the magazine. And I'm telling you about this restaurant, but you have to eat there. You know, this reading about this restaurant is not the experience. Going to the restaurant and eating there is the experience. Reading about this new ballet is not the experience. I'm just telling you, you should go to the ballet and see this. So that's what I mean by magazine culture. And that was very, when you had things, there was so many magazines like The New Yorker. And I'm sure they still exist, but most of us don't know about them. But they're these cultural hubs for each individual place. You know, like the internet kind of, it shook all of that up. Because in a way, these magazines and the magazine culture I'm talking about was kind of erased by the internet. Because locality meant less. But when you didn't have, you know, like if you are, what is the name of that show? Donald Glover has the TV show. It's called Atlanta. Well, in the show, I think it's even the first episode, there's this hip hop song that he plays over the credits. It might even be like the theme song for the show. It's been a while since I watched the show, so I don't remember. But it's very unique because it doesn't have a chorus. So it's not popular hip hop. So I looked it up like when I first heard it. I'm like, what is this? Because I thought it was good. So I looked it up and it turned out it was a local Atlanta rapper. So when he does something like that, you know, we'll ignore the fact that it's television because we'll refer to it as streaming because that's the internet, right? That song can all of a sudden sell albums everywhere. So culture becomes this thing that's accessible outside of locality. But before the internet, it was more important to focus on local scenes because if you were going to go anywhere, you had to first conquer the local scene in a sense, especially as a musician, right? Become a local, popular local musician, and then somebody wants to take you on tour with them, or they want you to open for them. Then they want to take you on tour with them. And then you start to build your own audience and you start selling albums and then you become a national act. The internet cut most of that out, which is good and bad. It's good if you're the artist, that you don't have to cut your teeth for so long, you know, that you could be like Justin Bieber, right? Put some songs on YouTube, I think it was, and then boom. You're famous. But at the same time, it loses that local flavor and the uniqueness of each place. Everything becomes a bit homogenized, that every city becomes a little bit more like every other city. You know, like right now, you probably would never have an East Coast versus West Coast rap feud because is the East Coast and the West Coast, is the hip hop really that different? Not really, because everybody's listening to the same shit. Whereas before, everybody listened to the same shit on, you know, like the top level, but there was a huge chunk of stuff that they listened to that was only stuff they knew. You know, like if you go and watch on Hulu, you watch the first season of Wu-Tang Clan. What's it? It's Wu-Tang Chronicle, I think is what the actual show is called. You will see that happening for them, that they will have these tapes, right? They just one tape, one song, and they'll be walking around their neighborhood and hearing people playing it on their boomboxes. Nobody else in the world's hearing it, just like not even all of Staten Island, probably just that neighborhood is listening to that song. So that's what, when I say magazine culture, that's what I'm thinking about, because magazines were these important collectors or curators of the culture happening around. Another side of the magazine culture was zines, which, yes, it is just an abbreviation of the word magazine, but zine and magazine are different things. Zine is it's mostly a punk rock thing as far as I've experienced it. It's like making your own magazine, except, you know, you're not publishing a magazine. You're just writing some stuff out on paper, sometimes like notebook paper, which Sharpies was, a lot of the punk rock ones were done with Sharpies. They'd have art and they'd have writing and they'd have like song lyrics in it and stuff like that. And then they'd go down to Kinko's or whatever Xerox place they had, and they'd copy a bunch of them and they'd sell them or give them out. That was zine culture. People try to bring it back continually. Actually, my friend Colin likes to create zines. My other friend Eric used to create zines. Zine culture was it's like making a mixtape for people. Instead of buying them a tape, you make them a mixtape. And the more I started thinking about those things, the more I started realizing how connected this was to some of the other things that I've been talking about and I've been thinking about for like the last couple years. So you had magazines, magazine culture, you had zines, something obviously that inspired this. Late night radio, late night talk radio, public access television. I've had this idea of public access television in my head. I don't even know if I watched public access television when I was younger, but just the knowledge that it existed burned something into my head. And something else I talked about when talking about this, the idea of the classic blogs, you know, back in the day when the blogs weren't dedicated to one topic, it was dedicated to the reader or the writer, and the writer would jump topics as they saw fit. That this blog might talk about politics, also might talk about jazz, and also might talk about fishing. I don't know why I use fishing as an example so much. I've only been fishing once in my life, and it was disastrous. So one thing I discovered not too long ago was a streaming service called Night Flight. And I have no idea how I found it. But Night Flight, essentially, it's essentially the original of something that I knew of, but I was just a little too young to know what Night Flight. I knew what Night Flight became. So there was a cable channel back in the day, probably still exists, called USA, USA Network. And late at night, USA used to have a show called USA Up All Night. And it was kind of a more adult show. Not as in dirty or, you know, like they still had to follow the airwaves. You know, it was cable, so they could maybe be a little risque, a little more risque. They could make dirty jokes and stuff like that. And one of the hosts was Gilbert Godfrey, and then later it was this woman named Rhonda Shear. I would watch it every once in a while, but I was pretty young. We're talking about the late 80s. So I didn't get most of it. You know, I was not an adult. But that show was originally Night Flight. What Night Flight, essentially in Night Flight, got changed by people at the network, you know, the people with the money that changed the show. And then it became USA Up All Night. So Night Flight is a streaming service that is not just the old episodes of Night Flight. There's actually not that many of the old episodes of the original Night Flight on there, but it is a streaming service dedicated to the original ideology of Night Flight. And the original ideology of Night Flight was a TV magazine. Now, what part of this entailed was playing music videos. I think technically they started before MTV. But the difference between Night Flight and MTV was MTV was always aimed towards the mainstream. Night Flight was aimed towards more of the, I don't want to say the underground, even though, I mean, there's a certain aspect of that, but more towards the art house end of music videos. But the interesting thing about Night Flight as a streaming service now today is, like I said, not only do they have those old episodes, and there's only so many of those old episodes they can play because they need the copyright for the music videos in the old aired shows to be able to do it, which I guess they don't have. So what they did is they started collecting other things into this service that fit into their aesthetic, including B, C, grade D horror movies, blaxploitation flicks, a whole bunch of like punk rock and like indie and old rock and roll documentaries, and then some stuff from old cable access television shows. And one of those television shows was something called Glenn O'Brien's TV Party. Now, I'm not positive, but I think this TV party is a TV party that Henry Rollins was referencing in the Black Flag song, TV Party. Glenn O'Brien's TV party was chaos. It was this New York cable access television show where people would show up, but it was just, I couldn't even begin to explain it, but it was an explosion of culture. You had like the Debbie Harry from Blondie was on there all the time because this is at the time when before Blondie was one of the biggest bands in the world. They were just a band that happened to be around New York. So in a way, cable access television in the case of TV Party functioned much like Night Flight and functioned much like magazines. This nexus of culture. And the weird thing when I look at all of the things, you know, that I've collected so far, the weird thing I start to realize is so much of it revolves around the 80s and the 90s, which, I mean, it makes sense, right? I grew up in the 80s, the 90s, I was a teenager and a little bit into my 20s. So like what some people refer to as the prime of your life occurred for me during those times, but I don't think that's what it is. I think the reason that those eras, there's two reasons I think those eras stick out for me is number one, that was a time when I was developing my own sense of what was interesting to me. So this stuff became part of my DNA in a way, even though like some of it, like I said, I didn't even actually experience. Just the knowledge that they existed imprinted something on the DNA of my creativity. And the other thing is this is everything that I'm talking about pretty much is before the internet boom. Now I say the internet boom because the internet did exist during all of this. It just wasn't, culture really. It was culture in the same way that, a band, you know, like an indie band that only like 300 people know about, and four of them happen to be your friends, you know, or in the way that D&D was culture. It was niche. So once I connected to those eras, I started to connect other things like, oh, I've been interested in that. Why has that been in my head? Why has that been in my head? Like PBS shows, kids PBS shows from when I was young, that they're in my head. Why are they in my head? Why are they important to me? Because in the same way that these magazines were exploring and discovering culture and creating culture, PBS was as well. PBS was new, right? They were still figuring out how to do these things. So they had all these different shows and they were experiments. And they didn't last very long, some of them, you know, other than Sesame Street, which is still on the air. And what else was burgeoning at that time that I also connect with that? Video games. I'm not much of a gamer on modern games now, but like, I love watching documentaries about old video games, like The King of Kong. Or there was this like documentary series about the development of Nintendo. Actually, I don't even think it was just Nintendo. It might have been Atari into Nintendo. All of that fascinates me. I like to watch documentaries on VHS culture. Same time period. Because I remember walking into video rental stores and it was just different. It was different in the sense that the movies, they needed to fill the shelves, you know, because these were independent stores at the time. This was before Blockbuster. They needed to fill the shelves. So you could go in and here's this shelf and here's like the two movies that maybe are famous next to like 12 B movies or D movies or C movies, you know, all the type of stuff I described that was on Night Flight or is on Night Flight. Because they had to fill the shelves. Here's Halloween Part 2 next to Frankenhooker and The Hitcher. And yeah, no, I didn't get to rent those movies when I was a kid. Most of the reason that I'd be in the video stores, mom would be renting whatever she's going to rent, and I was renting a Nintendo game. But I would walk around the store, and I would see these covers, and that collision of low culture and high culture. Not low culture. I'm stuck on the B movie thing. But that collision of mainstream and underground, or not even underground, but niche. I guess it imprinted on my DNA too. And all of this stuff is tied together. And that's probably why CNN had this series that I saw on Netflix called The 80s. It was like 6 episodes about the 80s. And I was totally into it, to the point where I was like, man, I would love to go back and just live then instead of now. You know, whatever, Reagan, whatever, who cares? It worked out. Okay. You know, like nobody got nuked. Or there's another show on Netflix that I love. Some of you might love too. It's a pretty popular show. The Toys That Made Us. Because that toy culture too, like what they were doing with toys, they were discovering something new then too, which is like, hey, let's make these toys and then we will create cartoons to sell the toys, which is like the most consumerist thing to do. But the people that they had doing it, because nobody else knew how to do this stuff, were actual artists. You know what I mean? Now they would pick somebody who was like a specialist, an expert. But back then they just like, oh, who can draw? Well, that guy can draw. Let's make him, have him make a cartoon. So there was this freshness to it. I imagine this is probably how a lot of people felt about rock and roll in the 50s and the 60s. Like, whoa, this is being created. Or hip hop in the late 70s and the 80s. Like, whoa, what is this new thing? Both of which, by the way, things I mentioned there, I'm also completely fascinated with. Which I didn't even have on this paper. So when you can throw in there too, you can throw in the early days of the internet. Like I mentioned earlier, the early blogs. But there's these weird, you know, remember all the forums? I mean, they still exist, but mostly when we talk about forums now, we talk about QAnon and the nonsense and racism that happens in those places and the child pornography. But I mean, like, when that was like the main mode of communicating was a chat room or a forum, it was different. It wasn't this underground place where all that stuff probably happened then too, but it was like right in the midst with everybody else that happened to be on there. But we didn't live on the internet, right? You know, you go and you check it out and it was just like another thing you did in your day. Like, oh, what'd you do today? Oh, you know, we went to the park and then I stopped by the library, returned that book. We stopped at the grocery store. We watched a movie. We went on the internet for about 20 minutes and we checked out this forum. And then with this and then this, you know, like it was just a small nugget of the day. Well, that period was ripe with a lot of interesting things. Like a lot of weird shit happened there. Like there's these weird internet mysteries. There's this great podcast called Red Web. And sometimes they cover those internet mysteries. So I'm totally fascinated with that. I mean, I imagine some of you feel some of what I'm talking about, but maybe not for the same reasons. But you might feel that nostalgia for that time. I can only assume this because Stranger Things is a very popular show. And Stranger Things, that especially that first season, grabbed all of us by that nostalgia, by the nostalgia nuts. Remember this? Remember how that felt to live then? Now, I never played D&D myself, but I did have other TSR books. TSR is the company that would publish the game books for D&D. They also made other books, not in the D&D universe, but the same game mechanics. And these were the ones that I would buy were on Marvel Comics, because I was way into Marvel Comics, you know, like when you were a nerd for liking that stuff. When they couldn't make a good Marvel comic movie to save their lives. So I would buy these TSR books on the Marvel D&D type platform. I would never play the game because I was an only child, but I would just buy the books because I like to look at the characters and read about them. And that also led me down to discovering something at a local comic book shop, which actually I'm only about 10 blocks from right now. It still exists. It's just under a different name. But I used to buy these things called the Official Handbook of the Marvel Universe. And these weren't comic books. They were like encyclopedias for the Marvel Universe. So you would open them. They were alphabetical, just like an encyclopedia. You'd open up the one you had, and you'd flip, and you'd be like, oh, okay, Captain America. Real name, Steve Rogers. And it would just give you the stats on every character, and then it would tell you the general story of the person and what powers they had. You know, if it was like a character like Captain America, it could be like 6 pages long. If it was like a minor character, it might just be 1 page. But there would always be like one full body image of the character. So originally I bought it because I used to have this obsession with tracing paper, because I figured if I could trace the things that I wanted to be able to draw, that I could learn to draw them. So I used to use the tracing paper to trace the characters from these books. And then, of course, I would read about the characters as well. And then I started to create my own characters, but I would use like the shape, the outline of characters to like give me like a body definition, but then I create a new character. So I was like totally into these. And then DC had ones that were similar, except the DC ones were called Who's Who. And they didn't come like in a paperback book. They came like a comic book. So they were like way shorter and they would get destroyed a lot quicker. But all of this was, like my thing, right? And a few years ago, because of all of this, you know, like all of that being important, I picked up this book called The Empire of Imagination, which was about Gary Gygax and the creation of D&D. And I ate that book alive. So now like I'm getting down. We're like halfway through these notes. It's a long episode. Halfway through these notes. And I still have no idea how all this stuff is connected, except that I kind of get that it's all about the same era, kind of. But I'm not getting as much as I'm getting out of it now, which is the realization that all of this is about things being, you know, niche cultures and the birth of new things and the mystery of the new things, right? I'm only getting that now. A few years ago, I bought this CD. I don't even remember where the hell I found this. I used to go, I think I've mentioned before, I used to go and I would look at used CDs. And, you know, so it was $3. I would buy it, even if I didn't know what it was, just because it looked interesting. Kind of like what people do with records. Crate digging, right? I would do that with CDs. And one of the things that I bought was this. I almost had a memory of where I bought it. I bought it. I was out of town somewhere, and I went into a record store. And I bought it. I have no idea where I was. Well, anyways, it was this. I have to find it. It's probably in the garage. It was this CD of. So there was this record label, this small record label, in I assume it was like the late 60s, early 70s era. And I guess they had like a decent moment of popularity, but they were never like, they never had any huge national acts. They were like this record label that was mostly local to whatever state they were in. I don't remember. I want to say Georgia. But I guess at a certain point, the business just fell apart. Something happened and the business, it went under. And they had these records, they had albums that had been recorded, but they just, you know, since it happened in the middle of it, nothing ever happened in these albums, this music. And it just sat there. And then like years later, somebody had gone to like the building, or I don't remember the whole story. This is all in the booklet of the CD. and they had found the tapes of some of this music. And now, mind you, the tapes were mildly fucked up, you know, like a little warped, and it wasn't perfect. And these were not like national acts, you know, you're not finding like these gems. It was just like this weird, interesting music that somebody's like, this is really cool. It's just different, you know, it's not like perfect, but, and it was just, they made this CD of like songs found from those tapes. And I would listen to that. Nobody knew what the hell it was. Nobody knew what it was in the back in the day. And nobody knew what it was when I bought this CD about it, right? So it wasn't exactly something that I could, it was very esoteric in the sense that like, you have to be in the mindset that I was like, this is interesting. And I'm interested in listening to something strange. You know, like Lou Reed had an album called Metal Machine Music, which was just like noise. You have to be a special kind of person to listen to that. So that whole crate digging culture kind of plays into this too, where it's like the idea of finding music that's just, you know, is it, just discovering the music with no connection to what it is. You're not picking it up because, oh, it's Radiohead and I like Radiohead. You're picking it up because you like the cover, or you're picking it up because it sounds interesting, or like it's just weird. I mentioned previously in one of these episodes that I was briefly twittering back and forth with the writer David Cadavy. And that conversation actually continued for a few days. And when we were talking about music, he had originally asked, just to refresh your memory, he had originally asked Twitter in general how you decide whether you're going to listen to streaming music or vinyl. And I had told him that I was on completely back on vinyl and I didn't have streaming anymore. So we kind of went back and forth about what that meant and how I was feeling about it. And he said he had just bought some records at an antique store recently. I said, what'd you get? So this is what he told me. Some Spanish guitar, an orchestra playing Gershwin, and a 78 with a beautiful song that the record doesn't even say who's singing. None of this is available on Spotify, and I love that. That's exactly what I'm talking about. And this is when I started to understand what all of this connection, what the value of all of this was. It's the same thing as thrift store culture. It's the idea of creating your own universe. You know, you're not picking up records because other people have recommended them. You're picking it up completely independent of anyone else. And you're discovering something that's, at that moment, wholly and uniquely your own. You can't share it with anyone yet because nobody knows what it is. You can share the experience with them, but sometimes they won't get it, right? Like with my broken disco R&B music on that CD. It's creating, in a sense, creating a counterculture. And I was always obsessed with counterculture, in particular with the Beats, because Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg and William Burroughs, they were some of the first writing that I discovered that was uniquely my own. And when I was younger, whenever I felt like a place where I didn't know, you know, like sometimes life can be like a road. You're driving down a road and you get to the end and you're like, oh, this just empties into a field. I'm not getting anywhere on this road. I got to go back to where I started. Whenever I would get to a place like that, I would go back and I would read the Beat Reader. And the Beat Reader is essentially, it's just an anthology of different writing from writers from the Beat Generation. Or I would go back and read On the Road Again, Kerouac's novel. So counterculture was always tied into my identity as well. And that fit in here. And then I was like, oh, and that's how poetry connected, because I was so obsessed with poetry for so many years. Like my only writing that I used to do was poetry. And that's because of the Beats. Like they were the first language that I was given. Even before like I developed my own taste in music, they were my first language. And that's why I loved City Light books up in the city. Because you would go in there and it would be like books of poetry, books about Marxism, books about comparative religions, books you wouldn't see in any other bookstore. In a way, too, this, you know, thrift stores and all this, it connects to garage sales. Going to garage sales and finding something, you're like, that's awesome. You couldn't find it anywhere else because whatever it was wasn't mass produced. But there's this thing and you take it and you're like, that's mine now. Sweet. So I start to come to this realization that all this stuff is connected. And I start to realize that what I was doing originally, in some ways with random badassery, was trying to exercise some of my interest in creativity. That's what I originally did. But then it wasn't a rich enough field to stick with that alone for me. And then Lamb wasn't able to do it anymore. So it just didn't work out. So I kind of, in a way, just decided like I'm not the arts and stuff like that. That's just not my topic. And so I focused on the other things that I've been interested in. True crime, whatever, you know, like whatever this is developing into now, which I think is just an introduction to the elephant in reality. But in going through all this and realizing how much all of this means to me, I realized how much I was missing and all of the things that I've been doing. Not that anything I want to change anything I was doing, but now I had created this forum. You might remember me saying in a previous episode that I needed to make this show into something that could change shape in a way that would work as a container to catch all of the things that I needed to catch. Well, now I'm suddenly realizing that I have this thing that can catch all of these. It can catch all the things I needed to catch. Yet here are these things that I'd forgotten about that are so important and so a part of the DNA of who I am that I need to remember to bring that in. Even like the weird stuff that like I don't even know how I would begin to work that into stuff, into content. I hate using that word in this context, but it's appropriate. So the question I have written on the page at this point is, how do I combine all this stuff? I mean, even just from a logistic point, even if I was just going to share all these cool things that I remember, there's not one medium that can do it, right? YouTube, you can only do video, right? Well, not everything that you would want to share is able to be done on video. Blog, no. What if you want to share a video? Can't share. You know, what if you want to share a photo? What if you want to share a song? Twitter, Instagram, podcast, Patreon, none of it can catch it all. And a lot of this too is because of copyright and all that stuff that unfortunately gets in the way from really enabling people to become true cultural curators. So what's some of the stuff that occurs to me too, when I think of these PBS shows from the 80s, there's like this mystery involved with it. Part of it is because I'm remembering things from before I remember things in a way. You know, like I don't have a lot of concrete memories, but I have these like fragments. So these things are interesting to me for all the reasons I mentioned here, but also because there's something, some sort of memory mystery that I feel like I need to unravel. And you know, I love puzzles, right? Recently, I was listening to an episode of one of my favorite podcasts, Weird Studies, and they did an episode on Neil Gaiman's fantastical comedy, and I can't remember the official title, but it's Mr. Punch. And the book is about fragmented memory. And listening to the episode, I remembered why I fell in love with Proust. You know, I finally got Lamb onto the Proust bandwagon where he read it and he was like, oh, this is good. But nobody else, I could never get anybody else to read Proust. But Proust was extraordinary because Proust was an exploration of the mystery that memory is. That there are things that we remember that make us feel good, even if they're just a fragment. Like, whoa, why did that, why does that tree make me feel the way it does? What is it connecting to? In the way that all of these things were connecting in my subconscious. This also relates to what I said previously about walks and how when you walk without headphones, you start to connect things. Your subconscious starts to make ties. That door looks a lot like that door of that house that you barely remember from when you were like six. And then that becomes the mystery too. What was that house? Why do I remember that door? Why do I remember these shows from PBS? Why do I remember late night talk radio when I don't think I ever listened to it? Why do I remember public access television when I don't think I ever watched it? Why am I holding on to these things as part of who I am? And that's an interesting mystery. What I think it is what I've been craving is what I had before, prior to the internet. And this isn't an episode I'm putting this out on the internet. I'm clearly not against the internet. But before the internet, I, as an only child who moved a lot when he was younger, I was forced to develop my own culture, a culture of one, because I never stuck around long enough to absorb the culture completely of where I was. Because remember, culture was localized, especially for children. Culture was localized in the sense that what was going on at this school, the kids at this school were interested in, might not be happening at this school six blocks away. Because there were certain things, like every kid knew what G.I. Joe was and certain things like that. We all knew what Barbie was. But the games that you played with them and, what cartoon was more popular or, whatever it was. I wasn't around to develop that fully. Every time we would move, I would adapt to the next and then adapt to the next. So what I ended up doing over time was there were certain things like, that's valuable, I'm holding on to that. That one's valuable, I'm holding on to that. And it started to develop my own culture so that by the time I became a teenager, I had no context of popular culture. And obviously I learned it, but I had no context of it because I had developed my own bubble. My books, my Marvel books, my movies, the movies I watched, my games, the video games that I chose to buy. They were all mine. Trivial Pursuit cards that I used to sit and try to memorize. The Jeopardy board game that I would sit and try to memorize. These were me. This is what I would do in my room when I was by myself. Culture of one. And when the internet came around, I had access to all these resources. We all had access to these resources. So our culture, once again, it became homogenized. And I, just like everybody else, got interested. Not at first, I think, interested in internet culture. But then in time, that developed into just becoming part of mainstream culture. So there's a part of me the reason this snag was, there's a part of me going, remember the counterculture. Remember your culture of one. Remember all of this. Remember this era. Remember what this felt like. Because this is the rich and fertile ground that you felt under your feet all this time, but forgot was there. This is your place. This is your home. This is where everything you create becomes uniquely your own, because this is uniquely your own. I was having a conversation just before recording this text message conversation with one of my best friends. And what he loves to do is he loves to, it's not really window shop, but it is window shopping just on the internet for guitars. He just likes to look at guitars. And he'll send me pictures. And we'll text back and forth. I'll be like, I don't know about that headstock. That's a weird looking headstock. What's up with that pickguard? You know, like just go back and forth. Like, why does that have a humbucker? That's weird. And in today's conversation, we're going back and forth and we started to talk a little bit about guitar tone and guitar effects. And, you know, we were talking, for anybody that understands guitar stuff, I'll give you like a brief understanding of what we're talking about. Everybody else, this is going to sound like Greek, but I'll do my best. Humbucker is a pickup that has two coils, two magnetic coils. It's thicker. It's about it's about the size of a credit card. A single coil is half that. So sometimes they call them lipstick because it's just like that size. So my friend was looking at this guitar that had a humbucker and he's like, the knobs are supposed to be able to let you switch coils, which means that instead of using both of the coils in that credit card size thing at the same time, you could say, let me use just the top one or let me use just the bottom one. And you get minor tone differences, which can be apparently a pretty big deal. I've never been a personal fan of it. So we're going back and forth about that. Not arguing. We rarely argue. But I was just saying like, oh, have you ever tried that? I've never tried it. I've never had interest in it. And I realized that when it comes to guitar, like I really don't, I'm not the person who's like, I got to find a fresh new tone for this song. I'm the person that's like, give me like three or four different settings that sound good if I play lead, and they play sound good if I play rhythm, and I'll just switch between those four. Like, give me just like the meat and potatoes of that, because I know myself, and if I get wrapped up in all the complexities of that, I won't actually ever play. And that's why my favorite guitar player, I think, is Keith Richards, because Keith Richards is like, he's like a meat and potatoes guitar player. You know, I have the sensibility of Keith Richards, but I like a dirtier guitar than he does. So I like the sound of Neil Young and Sonic Youth. And then I realized as I was like formulating this in this conversation in my head as well, Keith Richards' simplicity, Sonic Youth, and Neil Young tone, like, oh, that's weird. You know, like that's just totally me. And I realized that guitar was like this one area that remained, like all this stuff that I've been talking about so far, that the mainstream culture had not infected my tastes on the way that I like to play my guitar and the sounds that I like to get out of it. That was still a culture of one. So I see so much here. You know, like I can see what this elephant, I have a good idea of what this elephant looks like. I just don't know what to do with it. And I think that is the next phase of the experiment, this grand experiment, is to find out how I begin to explore these things more. I know part of it is to stop letting mainstream culture lead me as much as it does. I'm not cutting it all off, but you know, like, I don't need to know what new movies are out. I don't need to know what new TV shows are out. I need to follow where I am to the next thing. You know, where you pick up an album and there's a song on it and you're like, I love that song. You open the liner notes and you're like, who wrote that song? And you find out it was a cover of another band that you never heard of. So the next album you check out is an album by that band with that song on it. You let the things feed you into the next thing. Or I should, is what I'm saying. I need to watch more. I need to live more in the 80s and the 90s in my head. I need to figure out what those fragments are too. Like explore the fragments. There's something rich and interesting there. You know, I had this idea years ago that that I only did one sketch of, but I had this sketchbook and I had this idea that when I would remember things like images from the past, that I would sketch them out. I might go back into that a little bit. The reason I stopped before is I'm not great at sketching from memory. I can sketch things in front of me, but like sketching from memory, I haven't developed that skill yet. But I can begin to explore these things more. That's the experiment. You know, like what happens if I dive into this? You know, how do I interconnect all of this stuff? I don't know. You know, what's do I, you know, like I know that certain things, like I might have to make a video. Certain things I need to put up pictures, and Instagram, I guess, will have to serve as like this visual image, or I could put on the blog. There's all these options, but none of those choices really matter. Because those are all just pieces of the elephant, right? I need to focus on the elephant. That's the message that this snag of revolution gave me. Focus on the elephant. Here you are, Mr. Elephant. Nice to meet you. I can kind of see you. What do you mean? I have one other thing on this piece of paper. And it connects to all of this, but it doesn't connect in a linear way. It's an adjacent point. But I have the word lists, L-I-S-T-S, written on the paper and circled. Creating a list has always been something that I've loved. And I didn't realize until going through all this today why. I think because a list is the true unit of culture. The thing that unites things is the list. It's the collection, the curation that creates culture. One black artist singing sad songs is one man singing sad songs. But when you pull together this person over here who did it, and this person over here who did it, and this person over here who did it, and you collect them together, you make a list, you make an anthology, you make a collection, all of a sudden you have something called the blues. It's culture. When you think about culture in the context of science, what is a culture? It's a place where you grow something, right? It's a place where you collect something. That the unit of culture is collection, curation, lists. So there's definitely going to be a website. There's going to be a section on the website folder called lists. And I'm just going to start putting fucking lists in there. That's where I'm starting. And then I'm going to go back and keep digging back into that past. That's my part of the experiment. I'm very excited about this. So if you're excited too, I hope that you'll stick around, listen to more episodes. You'll share episodes, which would be really nice. And if you want to dig into the back catalog a little bit, you should go back and check out episode 26, I Miss Robin Williams, because I referenced it multiple times in this episode. It's the episode where I talked about renewing my love of walking without headphones and about the initial conversations about music and returning to vinyl that I had with David Cadavy. And of course, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you can become a patron by going over to patreon.com/Chad Hall, where you'll get access to the experiment I'm doing now of daily episodes. I also have a new page on my website where you can see other ways that you can lend a hand, because that is not the only way to help out this podcast. So check out that link in the show notes, which will be titled, yes, you guessed it, as Lend a Hand. So thanks for listening. All right, that's enough for tonight. I'm getting the raspy voice, so it's time to go. Good night.